a little bit from, not from the standpoint of introduction, but why it is that I'm teaching this particular session is my wife and I spent the first part of our married life with me in secular work. I worked in mechanical contracting, though I had grown up the son of a preacher. My dad preached for over 50 years, primarily in Colorado. And I did a lot of Bible class teaching, a lot of preaching at our home congregation, and even some at some other places. That wasn't my quote-unquote real job. And then one night, I said, I have had it up to here with construction. I told Tammy, I said, I think it's time for me to make, if for lack of a better term, a career change. And she says, well, I've been waiting on you to make this change for 15 years. And so at 38, I had an interesting experience. I was attending the Bear Valley Church of Christ in Denver, Colorado, and teaching part-time in their school of preaching there. And I quit my classes so that I could take my classes. I became a student. They wouldn't let me teach and do that, so they wouldn't even let me clep out of the classes that I was teaching. So I didn't do very good in those classes. I just want you to know. I graduated in May after the two-year program, and in September went back to teaching my classes again and did that for about 16 years and went into preaching and was with one congregation for 16 years. The congregation, when we arrived, had 9 members. It had previously had about 100. But as you know, in metropolitan areas, that when somebody doesn't like something, they usually don't stay to try to fix it. They just move on. And that was the case. They had been up to a little over 100. They hired a minister whose very first sermon was one that was offensive in just about every way that could be. He lingered for 9 months, but most of the members did not, and they dwindled in those 9 months to about a dozen by the time we got there, because they went for a two-year hiatus without having anything. Then we got there, and I almost quit in my first month because we were a family of 7, and I thought how great that would look on my resume, doubled size of congregation in 1 month. I thought that would look good. But we stayed and worked with that church, a group of fine people, and we were about 180 when we left. And for those of you here in Oklahoma, that may not seem a lot, but in Colorado, a big church is 300, 350. And so for a bedroom community / rural area, we really felt good about the work that was done there, and it was thanks to certainly the care of God, but a lot of hardworking people that, if you will, gave that congregation a chance and really put their hand to the plow and made some good things happen. So what I want to share with you is going to be more about what I experienced over that than it is some in-depth research. Along the way, I hope to give you some insights to some things that I have learned in addition to what I experienced. But if nothing else, I want to give you a little bit of hope, no matter the size of your congregation. Just by a quick show of hands, how many of you here attend a congregation that is regularly 100 members or less? Anybody? Just so you know, that represents the majority of the Lord's church across the country. The further you go west, the further you go northeast, the smaller those congregations go. And so it is not unique. And I think that's the best place for us to begin. You're not in a unique situation. I know that there are congregations that suffer a decline in their attendance for lots of reasons. It can be like what we experienced in Parker, Colorado. Sometimes your town dies. Now, the congregation is really small in Ponca City, but at one point in time, the gas and oil industry was huge in Ponca City, and the congregation there was well into the 400 mark. And then one day, that oil and petroleum people got up and they left. And when they did, so did a lot of Christians that left for no other reason than their job. And so they saw it. Sometimes your town, an agricultural town, dies altogether. And so some things are beyond your control. And we'll explore a little bit about how you can make the best, in fact, how it may be more best than you think that it is. But the place to start is to understand what I describe as the mega myth. The mega myth says that bigger is better. I'm going to take it away from a church setting. A few years ago, I drove into a Burger King. I have since said no more to fast food restaurants, not for my health, but because of my palate. It's just not worth it. But I drove to a Burger King, and I just needed a soft drink and a small bag of fries to kind of tide me over. I said, I would like a small Coke, and I would like a small fry. And the nice cashier lady said, we don't have small fries anymore. And I said, what do you have? And she goes, we have medium, large, and extra large. Why don't you just call them large, extra large, and triple XL if you're going to do it that way? Because I got the medium, and when it came, do you know what it was?
Small.
No, it's a medium. It said it on the, it was a medium. It was a small fry. You've been there, right? One of your favorite restaurants. And you'll go, yes, I'll have the medium soft drink. And they go, for only 10 cents more, right? We find ourselves walking out with the 55-gallon drum because it was only a quarter more. Because bigger has to be better. One preacher puts it this way, or actually he is a preacher, but that's not, he's a religious writer. The thing that you count is the thing that counts to you. And we like to count certain things, right? We count how much money the contribution is. We count the number of baptisms. And we count the number of people, right, in attendance. One church that I know of, they take the Sunday morning attendance, and then they have a small service at a local nursing home, and they take that attendance. And then they take the Sunday night attendance of everybody who partakes of the Lord's Supper because they were, quote unquote, providentially hindered, which means God kept them from coming that morning to the assembly. And they add that all together, and that's their attendance for the day. It's really not a good, valid number, right? Those are all the people that in some way you contacted. But even if somebody attends your service on a Sunday night that wasn't there on a Sunday morning, we would call that a unique visitor and probably deserve to be counted. So it's kind of a skewed number, but we like to put it on those boards because some guy somewhere is making all that funny church furniture, right? And we got these boards. What are we going to do with them? Because the song leader takes one, and then we got this other one, and the last thing we want it to be is empty, right? So we put that up there. I joke a little bit, but being in the church all my life, I get to do that. I'm part of this family. So this mega myth means everything is better if it's bigger. Now, for most of you, when you hear the term mega church, you're going to probably think about some televised denominational ministry. A mega church of 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 that's taken over an arena and is all about the show and not much about the go. Well, mega doesn't have to be that kind. There are some very large, very active, very faithful churches. But the mega myth says we will get big at all costs. And in some of those groups, they'll say we're going to do whatever it takes, and often that includes going as far as compromising on some doctrine. I'll just tell you right now, that's not a fair trade. Right? In fact, if you think about it, that's the trade that was made in the Garden of Eden. Right? Because man and woman, mankind, had everything and was given one instruction of something not. If you will, for the illustration, that was the teaching, at least all that we have from God. And they weren't satisfied with everything they had. They want everything that they couldn't have, but they wanted bigger, right? They wanted better. They wanted to be like God, and in exchange for that, they compromised the truth, and if you will, they lost everything. And we can do the same thing in our congregation. Here are just a couple of the things that I noted. I said, for example, we're going to employ the latest marketing strategy, right? We're going to compete with Madison Avenue. We don't use that expression much anymore because Madison Avenue is not the number one advertising community. But as a guy that had an advertising agency for 2.5 years, I need to tell you something. No matter how big your church is, you can't compete. You do not have the resources to compete with the advertising community as a whole. I remember a Tammy's face when I walked in. Excuse me. I walked in with one of the very first checks that I received while we had the advertising agency. It was for $85,000. And she didn't like the fact that I had a check for $85,000 and a catalog to Bass Pro under my other arm, because I had some. Now, of that $85,000, only about $5,000 belonged to me. The rest was on its way with the advertising for, listen carefully, for one magazine ad in 1 month. That's the kind of money that is being spent in advertising. You can't market at that level. You can't compete at that level. So if you compromise or you think that you're going to live that way, the other, and we've seen it, and I'm kind of sorry that we have lumped this all in the way that we have, but we're going to make an entertainment model, right? I don't know if any of you attend motion pictures. Maybe you've attended one of those motion pictures under the umbrella of the Marvel movies. And one of these is about the superheroes. And these movies are bringing in millions and millions of dollars. And after the credits, they have another little kind of a funny clip. And people are setting through all the credits, which we never used to set through. And there are thousands of people on these sets so that they can see 2 more minutes, but we can't get people to come back on a Sunday night. So what we need to do is we need to be a little more about entertainment. Now, I believe that we've set ourselves up for failure. I was talking with my friend Bob Turner just last night about this. We build an auditorium. We put at the front of it a stage. We put a microphone and we take one of our members, a paid one, and we put him up under the lights. We focus our worship towards what we talk about is the preaching, but we've done everything to make it a performance that we can, and then we're mad that the preacher starts acting like a performer, right? Now, I understand logistically that that's going to be necessary, especially in a large congregation, but we'll talk more about that fault in just a moment as well. And yes, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, they built Ezra a pulpit. Preachers love that one, and don't forget to feed the ox, right? Those are our two favorite passages of Scripture. And if you don't know what that's all about, I need to see you afterwards. But anyway, that's the entertainment model. Now, I think that sometimes we look at a church that has a quote-unquote rock band in as their music in their assembly, and we go, they're all about the entertainment. Statistically, the millennial generation isn't as concerned about the music as we think they are, and let's not just write off and go, they just went there for the music. There's probably something more to it, but there are churches that give away to that. And then this idea of, well, we need to broaden our fellowship. Right? We're not going to compromise our doctrine, but what we will do, and some of our so-called Christian universities are running into this. I recently was talking to a board member for one of our Christian universities, and he said, here's what's happening. He said, there is one pie out there to feed all of the universities. And so you look at it, and what we're finding is that to get my slice of the pie, I used to say, and I'm going to use his terminology, he said, we're looking for sound churches of Christ as our base. But what used to be this much of that pie is now becoming this much of this pie and becoming this much of the pie, and now it's a sliver. So those boards are saying, okay, we're not going to be real definitive on what makes a quote-unquote sound. And by the way, I'm not a fan of that particular term because it doesn't make any sense. Everybody's got their own definition. But he says, instead, what we're going to say is churches of Christ in general, however they are. And then, well, even if you don't call yourself Church of Christ, we're going to do this. Again, the designation doesn't matter to me at this point. What I'm saying is we're going to just keep adding and adding and adding and adding. And so without getting off into what's happening in our universities, it simply can be the same thing in churches. We're not getting enough people here, but if we partner with this group in town in regards to this event or this activity, we'll be bigger. So my question is regarding this is, who is in charge? Where are we really looking for our power to be the church that Jesus built? Now, I believe that we're to work hard. I believe that we're supposed to do what we're supposed to do, and that God has entrusted us to do some things in His plan. But it is, as one preacher by the name of Landon Saunders put it at the Harding University, it was 72 or 73, he simply put it this way. He said, God is going to do what God is going to do. But if we're not going to do what God wants us to do, He will take it from us and give it to another. So it's not whether or not God's going to get His work done. It's whether or not you're going to be a part of it. But all of the mega model is about us building ourselves up, us doing all the work and relying nothing on God. I doubt that any of us would have taken the first century model of church growth. That was growth at the end of a Roman lash. Right? That's not, you know, I think what we ought to do is find ourselves the most persecuted people and we will be the fastest growing religious group. By the way, we were not the fastest religious growing group in the world in the 50s and 60s. We were in 33 AD. That's when we were fastest growing. But none of us particularly like that idea of imprisonment, as Wesley put it, giving up everything. So something along the way has not only been changed, but I think Americanized as well. Much of what we face here in the United States is dramatically different than people are finding in the mission field. The things that we're wrestling with, we're arguing about, we're dividing over, those people said, I just walked two hours to get here to worship. I don't have the strength to argue about whether or not we should be goats on the left and sheep on the right. By the way, it's all perspective, because where you're sitting, you go, I thought we were on the right side, you know, so that kind of a deal. So the question is, in whom have we put our dependence on? And I contend that we are best served when we put the utmost confidence in God's power to grow His church, simply put, when people do what people are supposed to do or that He wants them to do. But let's ask, is a bigger church better? I would guess that all of you would say that the discussion in your congregation is, how can we grow? Because God does have something to say about numbers, right? I mean, whether it's that Jesus fed 5,000, or that there were 3,000 men on the day of Pentecost, or in some other way talks about new. In fact, I went into preaching because I thought there would be no math. I wanted to be an astronaut. They said math. I said, well, I want to be a crime scene investigator. They said, math. I said, what career's got no math? And they said, preaching. And then I start studying my way through the Bible and I get to numbers. They got a whole book of math, okay? So it doesn't work that way. But God's interested in numbers. But God is not ultimately interested in only numbers. In fact, you will find far more about God saying about the value of the little numbers over the big numbers, right? And we know that, and we go, yeah, I know that, but is it only 10 cents more for the bigger cup? So is it because I believe that it also brings a variety of problems along with it, okay? Any cat lovers in here? Yeah, see, they never, yeah, a cat, all, yeah, because, yeah, just your, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. If I said, how many are kitten lovers? Everybody raises their hand. Then we find out that they become that. But here's the thing. We see somebody with one or two cats and we go, oh, they have one or two cats. But if they have 1,000 cats, right, you're like, oh, they need help, right? Because a church full of cats is hard to wrangle. And so just because you're bigger doesn't mean you're better. In fact, I might point out to you that the model of destruction of cancer is growth, right? It's taking over a body, transforming that tissue into cancerous tissue, and no doctor would say, yeah, but here's the good news. You're growing. every day. Because the strength is not found in growing in size, it's growing in substance. And it's there that true church growth, whether you're small or large, is going to find its root, right? And that is, are we growing as individual? Now, here's what's interesting. Big churches have figured this out. It's the little churches that haven't. And that is that small is the new big. There are two very popular denominational preachers, one who is right here in Oklahoma City. His name is Craig Groeschel, or Groeschel, depending on if you want to sound like you know what his real name is or not. And Andy Stanley, who operates a multi-campus, single campus, 15,000 member congregation in Buckhead, Georgia, just north of Atlanta. And they are as successful in those in Christianity in its broadest sense as any are. But I got to hear them speak, and they concurred as they were speaking at the same, I mean, they were there talking about it, that their model of church growth has an enormous problem that has to be fixed. First of all, you need to understand how their model looks. Their model is that they have, though they might have multiple services over a weekend, sometimes as early as Thursday night through Friday night, depending on which campus it is, that it's only a kind of a one church service attendance. That's all you would go. But they might offer a 6:30 on Thursday, 6:30 on Friday, a couple on Saturday. I mean, they may do something like that. They don't do gospel meetings. They don't do vacation Bible schools. They don't even really do a whole lot of seminars on their campuses. It's a kind of a one-hit approach. They have a huge kids program. And then they said, but here's our problem. You can watch us online. You can be here on campus in one of the different campuses, or you can be at one campus at one of any of a number of services. And what we found is the sense of family is lost. We're not connected to one another. Even in their broad view of what makes the church, they recognize we're not really connected to one another, except we have a I Love Jesus bumper sticker on our car. The other side is follow me to my church, North Point. Okay, I mean, that's just the way that it is. And so what they needed to do was to come up with a model that would allow them to gain all the things, listen, that they lost in becoming a big church. And so they decided we need to be a large church of little churches. And they at least seemed to introduce the idea of the small group ministry. Now, from Andy Stanley's perspective, Andy Stanley says that our gathering time on a Sunday, Saturday, Friday night is to drive you to a small group. Because there, you're going to find a sense of family, a sense of intimacy, a place in which when we pray for one another, we really know who we're praying for and what's going on. Now, I tend to think that a small church growth model is great. I think that small groups actually drive people to the assembly. In other words, that's a side door opportunity. If you want to know more about that, be back in here in the next 45 minutes. But that it is simply a matter of these are little churches. Now, for some who lived through the early 70s into the early 80s, you know that within the Lord's church, we had a division of sorts. It was a rise that came out of Boston, Massachusetts, and Gainesville, Florida, a movement on college campuses that began a discipleship model and some things that just eventually ended up not being consistent with Scripture. And so the idea of a small group is paralyzing. But I would guess that every single one of you have been part of a small group. You just didn't know it. For example, you've been a part of a small group ladies Bible class on Tuesday or Wednesday mornings. Or you have been part of a small group as you were divided in your congregation into age-appropriate learning environments. Preschool, kindergarten, adult. And then we decided, well, we need to break up the adults, right? We have the 20s, the 30s, the 70s, the hospice. I mean, that's just kind of the way we seem to move it that way. I don't know what to call them. I've tried golden agers. I've called 29ers. I finally asked one person, I said, what would you like to be called? And he goes, old. That's just how I feel. Okay, if you're in the old class, it's over there, you know, near the restrooms and the handicap access. I mean, that's just the way that it kind of is. So we've all been part of small groups. This is just a more organized, and I think in many ways it is a more effective model. But here's my point. The big churches want to be what? A little church. A writer by the name of Francis Chan wrote a book recently entitled Letters to the Churches. And though I do not hold to everything that Francis Chan holds doctrinally, here's Francis Chan's proposal. The end of the big church. And as a guy who started two churches that ultimately became in excess of 15,000 members, he knows all about big churches. He says, enough about big churches. And his proposition, though I don't know how he will ever implement it, is that we go back to small groups of no more than about 20 or 25 that meets in homes. The end of the professional preacher, I don't like that at all. The end of church buildings and all that goes along with it financially. And it has received enormous praise. Again, most have said, yeah, but how do you take your congregation of 300 or 400 and say, starting next week, we won't be 500, 300, 200. We're going to be 25 here, 25, 25, 25, as he has seen it in the mission field, primarily in China. But the idea is this. Big churches have figured out that where you are as a small church is actually in many respects where they want to be. There is greater advantage in that. Now, I understand that more resources, more staff members, a bigger building, greater amounts of money in the bank afford us opportunities of things that maybe we didn't think that we could ever do or that we even could. In other words, I can't be as much of a service to this community if we're just holding on for dear life ourselves, but if we're bigger. There certainly is some of that, but we're finding out that this sense of community and this sense of family is something that's being lost in the large church. I worked with the Southwest Church of Christ here in Oklahoma City for a time as their outreach and involvement ministry congregation, about 500 members. And this congregation had grown over time to that number, and some of those had individuals literally who were in their 70s had been there since they were children. I mean, it's that kind of, they've seen this congregation grow, and they said, it doesn't feel like family anymore. That was an indictment of the preaching. It was an indictment of the programs. It wasn't an indictment of the leadership, though there may be responsibility on those and other factors, but it was this. You're not going to be a family. Go to a family reunion sometime that has 500 people. You're going, is that Aunt So-and-so's kids, grandkids, kids, grandkid, right? There's 8 to 10 exits out of your building. That sense of family, unless you're in some kind of a grouped situation, is going to be almost impossible. If it's true that you only really know about 70 people at any one time, I mean, about what's going on in their life, you're significantly behind the curve in a congregation of that. And so first of all, it is to realize that a sense of family and a sense of community, not exclusivity, not where you're saying it's us and everybody else, but simply saying we have what many big churches don't have, and that is a true sense of family, community, where we know one another. Secondly, is involvement. I know the thought is that if we have more, then we'll have more involvement, when in fact, statistically, it's just the opposite. A congregation in just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, actually over the line in South Carolina, is the product of a church plant. They're running about 350 or were, but they're getting ready to plant their second church. They send 80 or so of their members out to start the new church. In fact, they already have elders that are appointed that will go with that group. They're going to truly be a separate group, and this is the second time they've done it. And I asked one of their ministers, I said, okay, wait a minute. here you are, right? You're doing good. You're 300, 350, lots going on. And all of a sudden, you gut your church of 80 people because they didn't send the people that were the discontents. They didn't send the people that weren't doing anything. They didn't send the people that were, we might call, the fringe members. These were the people that were excited about going to work. I said, boy, that leaves you with what? The bad givers and the frowny faces. He says, here's what we've experienced every time. He says, not only have we found continued place to grow, but people began to step forward because they, in that bigger model, thought somebody's already doing it. My humble talents won't mean much of anything. And so when those that were the most equipped left, those that didn't feel that they were as equipped, they were able to step forward and take their place. When we went to Parker, we had a good friend who really helped in the early days of that church. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack and died at 48. He was his name was Gene Perry, a Baylor graduate who always told me about Billy Bob Joe Jack from Aspermont, Texas. He always had a joke about that guy. And Gene Perry had this cheesy grin, big bushy mustache. Gene was about 6'1", 6'2", and cowboy to the core, and was not that great of a singer. But we needed song leaders because, first of all, if I did the preaching, the praying, and the song leading, we would get an organ. Okay, that I'm not going to go into the doctrine of that. It's just practical. We'll need. I'd be beat. So everybody that was there had to take a look. And Gene would get up every time, and he would say this. He goes, "This may be off key, but it's going to be done in a hurry. Let's go." Right. So we didn't ever lag with Gene leading singing. But I have seen teachers that step up because there is no one else. I have seen song leaders step up because there is no one else. I have seen young men who have taken the pulpit far earlier than they might have. So recognize that it does not necessarily mean that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get more involvement because you have more people. Let me tell you, there are lots of big, lazy churches, right? In fact, one of the things that we experienced at Parker as we began to grow is that there were some people that weren't very happy there because they were asked to be involved. They thought, congregation, suburb of Denver, we can go out there, nobody will ever know when we're coming, when we're going, what's going on in our life, I won't have to do too much, right? Nothing's happening there. We walked in the door and we slapped a volunteer sticker on them and said, get a shovel, let's go. I mean, that's the way that it was. And we did. We had multiple families that didn't stay because one of them admitted, you guys knew too much, wanted to know too much about us. We had to be too much. We didn't fill the front pew, but I'll tell you, nobody sat on the back pew very long because they were either moving up or they were moving out. And so to recognize and realize, now, I will say and I will caution that it can lead to burnout. You will wear out because if you take the old idea that 1% that 10% does 90% of the work, well, do the math. If your congregation is 60 members and you're going, okay, I won't do the math. Remember, I don't do the math. But you're going, yeah, that's going to fall on a handful of people who are doing everything. We don't have the time to talk about maybe the everything is your problem. You've built so many trellises and are standing there waiting for the roses to grow instead of going, let's build our programs as our congregation grows. Not saying, well, there's only 40 of us, but we know women's ministry, we know men's ministry, we got a kid's ministry. Don't forget, we make a Bible school, gospel meeting, because if there's a day on the week that has a Y in it, we need to have something going on. And twice on Sunday, if we can get them to come back. Number three, so we have our community, we have our family, we have the involvement. Number three is the fact that communication is better in a small church. In fact, sometimes communication in a small church is too better. You know what I'm saying? Yes. I mean, Tammy and I, we attended, I preached for a small congregation in Denver. It was the most ragtag bunch of people ever. I think at that point, Mr. Warren's Miller Street, you've been there on multiple occasions. These people came out of alcoholism and abuse and addiction. There was, at that point in time, they probably had about, 50 on a good Sunday, you left there thinking you were the greatest person, the greatest preacher in the world, even if you weren't. You preached there, haven't you, Mr. Warrens? That had nothing to do with you when you thought you were the best preacher. But they were just that way. But I remember that one of the members got up and he said something to the effect of, he said, we just want to continue to pray for Sister So-and-so. Her hemorrhoids have gotten really bad. And everybody in the congregation went, oh, really? How bad are they? I mean, that's the way that it was. There was way too much communication. But at the same time, everybody knew what was going on. One of the church secretary from the Creekside congregation, Greenville's here. I had to think of her. I didn't get a chance to share it. But it said, yes, that's today. I've had it in the bulletin every week for the last 6 months. But we don't know, right? We don't know what's going on because things are big. There's lots going on. People have a tendency not to be as engaged. But it is hard when you're 30 or 40 or 50 members not to really know what's going on. I mean, like a minute-by-minute update. You know who misbehaved in church. You know who was late, who got up early, who double-dipped in the Lord's Supper. I mean, you know everything. And that's to your advantage because you can leverage that. It allows it to be more personal. It allows you to make changes even on the fly, right? Now, I will say that sometimes you go into a congregation. I was recently at one in which the preacher got up and he says, it's really nice to have Wayne here tonight. He goes, do we have somebody leading singing tonight? Who's leading singing tonight? And the ladies immediately looked to somebody else, right? Two of them went, well, if nobody else is going to do it, somebody's got to start the song. But the point was, you can be too casual about it. If you've ever been in a congregation where there is a checkbook for all the bills and a couple of volunteers, they're not elders, they're not deacons, they're not ministers who keep the checkbook, and you'll see them over on a Wednesday night and he'll go, yeah, I picked up the mail. There's the electric bill is in there, and here's the bill for the trash. Okay, yeah, let me just write those checks. I mean, you've seen that kind of cigar box kind of finances. But you know what? Everybody know what's going on. Communication is better. And then four, and it may not apply to everybody in this room, but I think it has a significant impact, and that is the fact that leadership is easier in a small congregation. If for no other reason, there are less complainers. Only Bob got that, you know. But the truth is this. It is hard, if not impossible, for a group of shepherds to effectively shepherd a congregation of 2,000. I don't care how many shepherds you get. It logistically, that's why in the corporate world, you don't see the board of directors, though I hate to equate those two, you don't see the board of directors running the whole company. There is a tiered situation. You can't tier it enough and keep a church model as described in the New Testament that allows you to shepherd a congregation, to lead a congregation that is 2,000 members. There are some that are doing a great job of it, but I just said they're doing the very best of a bad model, and that's why I am an advocate of smaller congregations, if for nothing else from the perspective of the ability for shepherds to shepherd it. They can know about needs, they can know about changes, they can know about problems, and they can deal with those on a face-to-face basis. I worked for some big companies when I was in the secular world, and for me, there were two kinds. There were the ones in which there was that hierarchy, and there was the owner or the president of the company, and there were the vice president, and those who were the those kind of the next tier, and then it got all the way down to those of us, the lowly employees, right? I've also been on the top of that tier in a corporation, and I can just tell you, I didn't know everybody that worked for me. And I know that in those situations, everyone that I worked for didn't always know me. But when I worked for the mom and pop shops, in fact, literally at one job in which the office was in the back of the house of the guy that owned the company, I had to walk through his kitchen to get to my office. So I knew his wife, and I knew his daughter, and I knew his dog, because that's the way it was. And so from a leadership perspective, it's really good. I might put it just this way. If you think that bigger is better, ask Goliath. Right? Ask Goliath. Here are some things I want to leave you with. We're about out of time. We are about out of time. So I want to leave you with some real practical things that I think that you can do in a small church. Number one is work with what you have. Quit thinking about, well, if we had this, we would be able to do that. You know, if you've got a garage, you know that just because you have more doesn't mean you're getting more done, right? So it is that work with what you have. If you have a ragtag bunch of Christians who you're not sure how they got their pants on, then getting the pants on ministry may be the place to start. Work with what you have. Find that secret of satisfaction, that contentment. As God blesses you, I'm convinced that God blesses churches not that want more, but that do the most with what they have. That God, we even felt at Parker that there were a couple of times I said, we're doing everything we're supposed to do, and from a human perspective, we're doing it all right. Why aren't we growing? Well, we weren't doing everything, and I think God says, I'm not giving you more to do until you're ready to do with what I've already given you. And we found that once we did that, God blessed us. There's a congregation that recently reached out to me and said, we want to start a prison ministry. And I said, I don't know much about it. I can put you in contact with a couple people. I said, I didn't know that you had a prison there. And he says, well, actually, he says, the closest that we have, the closest jail is 90 miles away. And I think that's great. And there are certainly people in those situations that need to find Jesus, right? But that might not be your niche. That may not be the best use of your abilities. Don't think that you have to do all those things. Work on those. And as I said, practice excellent. Number two, tap unexpected resources. That is to say that take the people that you have and don't put them into a situation that they're not equipped to. Say, this is their talent. We had a lady at Bear Valley who was excellent teaching the sixth grade classes in the subject of Christian evidences. It's the only class she'd teach. And she did a fantastic job. And everybody's like, well, how are we going to get Myrna to teach in the other classes? And I'm like, don't. Find somebody else who's great in the Old Testament, somebody who's great teaching the life of Christ. Find those individuals, because sometimes people go, I don't know. Well, I'm a perfect example. Jack of many trades, master of absolutely none, right? Find something that those people do well. Number three, be creative. And what I mean by that is be flexible. Don't should everything to death. Just go, all right, here's what we can do, and here's what we want to do, and work towards that. But you might have to think a little bit outside the box. And then finally, focus on what really matters. For more than 20 years, I directed Vacation Bible School. I prided myself on being a Vacation Bible School themologist. I could have a theme for everything. Cowboys, aliens, circus, you just tell me what you want to do, and I'll find a theme for it, and I'll be as good as Disney. But you know what I found along the way? That sometimes the theme became the thing, and it wasn't. One year I had a great concept. We are aliens, right? Strangers and aliens. What a great thing. Kids love all those little green men and space saucers and everything. Do you know how many of our second graders connected the fact that we are aliens with we are aliens? None of them. Was it a great VBS? Well, we had a great time. We had some great decorations. The adults went, that's great, we're aliens. They didn't know any more than the second graders did. Because it was so much the fact that we went, okay, we're going to have to remember, what's our objective? How are we going to connect the attendees of our Vacation Bible School to the truth of God's Word? And so sometimes they go, well, what's our theme? And they're like, well, that's kind of lackluster. And I go, but the theme's not the thing, right? We got to make sure that we communicate that. Here you go. These are some church growth principles that I want to leave with you. Number one, individual spiritual health is fundamental for growth. Grow congregations on an individual basis. Churches don't grow because people don't grow. The examples are throughout Scripture, throughout history. You will not grow a church that doesn't have people growing. Number two, biblical nutrition is what grows people, not programs, not having the best of. Number three, love for others is what provides the fertile bed for those people to grow. If that is not developed in a congregation, you may have a room full of complete strangers that pack the house, but you're going to need that. Number four, that bold evangelism is a mechanism for church growth, but I wish we had the chance to talk about that. What you think is evangelism probably isn't evangelism. It's simply having those people as a whole. Number five, unity strengthens church growth. You don't grow if you're divided all the time about everything. About everything. About everything, right? Fix those kinds of things. Since I didn't put numbers on here, number next, as my friend used to say, that it is that discipline regulates church growth. Sometimes we think that we don't want to let anybody get away. A troublemaker, someone that perhaps needs to be disciplined by a church, and so we find ourselves allowing that to remain and pollute. Oh yeah, we're not getting any smaller, but we're certainly going the opposite way of growth. Rejoicing in suffering reflects church growth, because the growth is going to produce greater suffering. So here's my suggestion. Dream big, pray hard. Okay? What you have is what God has given you. It may be that you have the little boy's Lunchable. God will do something great in a little thing. And over time, as He sees fit, He will grant you more. Be thankful and do the same thing all over. We could have explored each of these in even greater detail, but hopefully this will give you a little encouragement no matter the size of your congregation. So I would invite you to take a little bit of a break here. Double check the schedule. We'll have another session in here on guest readiness. Bob, you are, I can't remember which of your twos are first here. Bob is going to be speaking, I think, really for those in leadership, but I think you would find it very beneficial about vision for the local church. And then Jeremy Beller, who started talking about preaching, is going to continue in Classroom B. So you might want to get a little bit of Wayne, a little bit of Beller, a little bit of Bob. That's the way it goes. Thanks, everybody, for being here.